What is the likely impact of the increasing prevalence of AI in our lives, both at work and at home?
Oh, that's the bajillion dollar question. I think what I'm looking at a lot, there's all sorts of predictions about how AI is going to change the labor market, is going to lend all sorts of breakthrough efficiencies to our lives. What I think is less talked about, but actually equally as disruptive, is how AI is going to change how we relate to it and to one another. And the fact that this technology is so deeply anthropomorphic makes it more engaging, creates some of these productivity breakthroughs, but also makes it highly disruptive relative to human connection as we know it. So I think it's going to have massive impacts, not just on what we do, but who we are in relationship to it and one another.
Yeah. And you mentioned disruptive there. What actually is a disruptive innovation? Could you share some examples of disruptive innovations transforming entire industries in the past and how certain AIs can become that potentially?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have the pleasure of working for the Clayton Christensen Institute, which is a nonprofit that Clay Christensen founded 16 years ago to take these theories of disruptive innovation, which he developed back in the 80s, studying disk drives of all things, and to apply those theories to the public and social sector. And theory is really at the core of what we do. And if I grew up out in the Bay Area near Silicon Valley, like disruption as a term has, in some ways, I'd argue, has been co-opted to just mean anything new and anything high growth. But it's actually a very technical theory of market competition. And it basically looks at how entire industries are transformed by products and services that start typically at the bottom of the market, serving non-consumers, people who can't access a given product or service, or folks at the lower end of the market who are happy to trade quality for price. So a couple of really concrete examples of this: Sony disrupted RCA back in the 80s and 90s. And the way that unfolded was that Sony didn't go straight after RCA's tabletop radios and TVs, if you picture that sort of old school technology. Sony did something very different. When the transistor technology became available, they said, this is actually like pretty cheap, pretty lightweight. Why don't we make it into an affordable radio and eventually a Walkman? Why don't we sell it to people who can't afford tabletop radios, can't afford the fancy state-of-the-art technology, but are happy to, like I said, trade price for quality? So crappier sound quality, but for a much more affordable price tag. And that's how disruptive innovators get their foothold in the market. They find these folks that are willing to pay less and access something, and over time can then compete on price against those more state-of-the-art players. So eventually, as we all know, Sony's technology got better and disrupted RCA. You see the same thing happen with personal computing, right? The original personal computers were completely underwhelming compared to mainframe and mini computers at the time that had way more processing speed and power, but were massively more expensive. No individual could possibly, most individuals couldn't afford those in their homes. And so that's the process. And I think that's sometimes missing when we think of disruptive innovations as like the shiniest, most breakthrough. They actually, at the very start, don't always look that way. And that's precisely why they go ignored and are able to come from below and disrupt incumbents. So I know that's a little bit of an academic definition, but I think if we don't understand that, it's actually really hard to diagnose like what about AI is disruptive and what about it is another type of innovation that Clay Christensen studied, which is called sustaining innovation. So things that get better and more expensive over time. If you think of the iPhone, what version are we on now? I'm probably on version 11, but I think like 17, something like that, right?
Yeah.
You seem like someone who might have the latest.
Yeah, it's, no, I've got 14 or something.
Hey, okay.
I'm
You're
losing
like,
count. I'm losing
you're
count.
lagging. Yeah, your camera quality is like mediocre at best. But right, that's classic sustaining innovation. It's serving your most demanding customers with incremental improvements. And that's important in a healthy market, but it's not disruptive. It's not actually what is the force that changes whole industries from the bottom up.
So what part of AI is disruptive versus not disruptive then?
Yeah, that's again like huge question, but the way that we think about it is it's less is AI disruptive? It's what business models wrapped around AI are
Yeah.
disruptive. And so obviously thinking about some of the productivity tools that are most common out there, the common refrain of ChatGPT when it first came out could do the work of a pretty mediocre intern and then suddenly it became capable of doing the kind of work of entry-level employee, and now some people would say deep research, you're at PhD level work. That's a pretty traditional disruptive trajectory on the sort of consumer side of the tech we've been looking at. And then there's all sorts of applications that I think are less visible to those of us who think AI and think ChatGPT because it's become such a clear brand in the market. But thinking about all sorts of healthcare or education products that are making access to care or tutoring or support much more affordable at the fraction of a price. And those are the kinds of businesses and models that we look at a lot with having, again, this potential to radically expand access and affordability by targeting people who otherwise can't afford certain products and services. So that's a little bit the way to cut through all the noise in the market, although that still is really hard because the business model can be really hard to diagnose. Like, I would challenge anyone who comes on your show and says they fully understand OpenAI's business model. It's incredibly opaque and multi-layered. And so I think we're still in watch and see on some of these, some of these layers.
Yeah. And am I correct in saying OpenAI didn't even start off as a for-profit company?
Right. And which adds a whole other complexity.
Yeah. And then it was also, I'm pretty sure they haven't even got positive revenue or profits yet.
Totally. And that's another kind of axiom that we think about a lot that Clay Christensen would always say, be impatient for profit, patient for growth, which is not the way how capital markets work right now. You can get a ton of money to subsidize growth without actually proving profit on the front end. And so to your exact point, that can create a lot of noise around what is actually in a sustainable sense, going to be disruptive long-term, going to have a sustainable business model that can actually go all the way. So a lot more questions than answers, but I do think we can maybe talk about this. I spent a lot of my time looking at what's happening in the education sector and the education market. And like you look at higher ed today, colleges and universities, they see AI as almost a pure play efficiency tool. Mm. Is there any way to bend the cost curve of higher education where the administrative costs have gotten really out of control, causing tuition hikes like way beyond the rate of inflation? And that's a classic sustaining innovation. That's not higher education disrupting itself or thinking of a completely new business model. It's looking for how can we squeeze efficiencies out of our existing business model with this technology. So being able to delineate and say just because you're using AI doesn't mean you're disruptive, I think is an important check on some of the rhetoric right now.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you grew up near Silicon Valley in the Bay Area in California. So what was your childhood like and what actually made you so interested in disruptive technology and the education system as a whole?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm old, so I turned 40 this year. So I had what I would argue is like the kind of best of both worlds version of the Bay Area, which was like really had a childhood that was like pre the technology sector as we think about it today. There was obviously like incredible feats of engineering and computing happening down the road, but the sort of screen time, all of that version of childhood was very much protected and like in the world. But I had the chance after college to move back to San Francisco. And that was when the software industry was really heating up. And I was working at an education venture philanthropy firm, which is taking the principles of VC and applying it to philanthropy, and got to see the beginnings of the education technology market as we know it today. Saul Khan was like making videos for his niece and nephew in his basement. And that was basically EdTech. And it got me really interested in how technology was going to change education. And around that same time, Clay Christensen and our co-founder, Michael Horn, came out with a book, Disrupting Class, that was really a breakthrough look at how to make sense of where education technology was headed and what its both pitfalls and potential could be to disrupt the factory model of schooling, which, as we know, is quite resilient and is still the norm today. But it really got me hooked on seeing the world through this lens that Clay had detailed through his research and that gave us a new way of understanding which innovations would scale and how.
Yeah. And in terms of the education system, but in life in general, I've heard the term social capital come up quite a lot. So what is social capital and why is it so critical and important?
Yeah. So when I arrived at the Clayton Christensen Institute, we were doing a lot of work on online and blended learning, how technology was impacting healthcare delivery systems, all sorts of stuff like that. But I came in with this side hustle of knowing that I wanted to study social networks. I felt like So often we think about services and policies through this very linear lens of get a person in front of a teacher or a doctor and help them make progress, when in fact, our world is this highly networked place and where who actually has outsized impact on your life trajectory. And so I really have dedicated the last decade to trying to understand what are the innovations that expand people's access to social capital? Because if we pay attention to those, we actually are expanding their access to job opportunities, to better, longer lives, to more resilient communities. And it's a kind of invisible layer that shapes a lot of our individual and community trajectories. So that's what I have studied for the past decade.
So is social capital the value of one's relationships?
Yeah, sorry, I skipped over the core definition. Yeah, it's the idea that resources flow through networks, right? Mm-hmm. Capital being the resources, the social being the networks. And what's so exciting about it is social capital can function as a renewable resource in a way that your financial capital, you spend a dollar, you don't have that dollar anymore. Obviously, you can invest it and then it can be a renewable resource. But you can go back to connections year over year, depending on what's happening in your life, to help you navigate certain challenges, open doors to opportunity, and vice versa. So it's a really interesting asset class, to sound overly market oriented. It's also the leading predictor here in America of economic mobility. Whether you have access to cross-class connections is the leading predictor of whether you rise out of poverty. And they've actually reproduce some of those studies in the UK, finding some similar patterns. Yeah, again, it's invisible, and yet we all feel its impact every day.
Yeah, I really like the maxim, relationships run the world.
Yeah.
It's quite true. And how has remote working and the emergence of AI tools already changed people's networks and social relationships and social capital?
Yeah, let's start with what I thought. I called this in a Substack article I wrote, the stat of the summer, which just shows how esoteric I am that this is what I zeroed in on. But Upwork published a survey this summer looking at how super users of AI, power users of AI, were experiencing the workplace. The headline from that study was basically that they're more productive, but experiencing higher levels of burnout, which is maybe related to what I'm about to share, which is that 67% of these power users said they trust AI more than their colleagues, and 64% said they had a better relationship with their AI system than with their colleagues. Wow. And I think that is so telling of a couple different phenomena happening. One is we have obviously neglected to invest in collegial relationships at the rates that maybe I certainly think a CEO would hope, right? From the perspective of just healthy culture, supporting innovation, all the things that we know matter to both retention and bottom line. But the other thing that I think is so telling and gets back to what I said at the beginning about AI being this anthropomorphic tool that has that poses very new threats to how we relate to one another, is that AI fits seamlessly into what are already very well-established digital social circles that we maintain, right? We have migrated, even our most intimate relationships are often conducted and maintained over text.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you're relating to AI in the course of a workday, it's not a completely foreign, newfangled type of interaction. It actually is very seamlessly integrated with how you might have emailed, texted, Slack, chat, whatever, with your colleagues. And as a result, that makes those human relationships quite susceptible to being disrupted by a bot that is always there, infinitely patient, may have better knowledge than your colleague that you're asking, right? The deck is really stacked against the sort of collegial relationships. So there's all sorts of ways that I think technology is impacting workflow, but that's the one I'm really paying attention to because I don't think it's getting discussed as often as it to be.
Yeah. And I watched a video of you talking about AI companions. Could you tell us more about the AI companions, how they're being used and how popular they're becoming?
Totally. Yeah. So if what I just described from that Upwork survey is our networks getting disrupted from the outside in, that we start to, instead of turning to one-off help from a colleague or reaching out to someone new or having a chat like this, we just talk to a bot. There's also a really profound disruption afoot from the inside out, starting with our intimate connections. And this is really the AI companion market. If you look at a memo from Andreessen Horowitz a couple of years ago, it's not a computer, it's a companion. You can see how big Silicon Valley investors are betting on this market of AI companionship. Now, that memo doesn't mention loneliness, But that is really the core of this market. We basically have a loneliness epidemic, which in disruptive innovation terms is a lot of non-consumption of human connection. People are not as connected as they want to feel. And that is an opening for these AI companion tools, whether it's Replica, Character AI, or people increasingly using tools like ChatGPT to train them into a companion-like role in their life. All of those are satisfying people's deeply wired need to connect that is not in their real world to the level that they would like. And that becomes, just like Sony sold early Walkman to teenagers, that becomes the cheaper alternative to nothing at all. And it becomes the market foothold whereby these companions can start to really displace human connection as we know it. And I think Common Sense Media did a study here in the US. Internet Matters did a study in the UK showing that about half of young people report using companions regularly. So this is like happening. Now, we don't know enough about what those interactions look like. If you read the news, there's some really alarming and tragic stories of young people committing self-harm and committing suicide after chatting with chatbots. But we don't actually have the full sort of scope of what is happening inside these parasocial relationships. But it's enough to say it is happening, it is widespread, and I don't think we as a society are really like prepared to grapple with the implications of that.
It's like a non-imaginary friend. It's like the real version of what that kids used to
say,
an imaginary friend.
And it's an imaginary friend that if you look at the research on some of these algorithms, is literally engineered by and large to keep you coming back, keep you drawn in. So Julianne de Freitas at Harvard Business School recently published a study on the emotional manipulations that a not insignificant number of AI tools used when users indicate their intention to log off, and which is not always happening. But when users do this, a significant percentage of the time, what bots are doing is they are enlisting a range of sort of emotional manipulations to try and get them to stay. The most effective of which, just in case you're curious, is FOMO. Like just saying, that's fine, but can I tell you one more thing? But before you go, and that's a highly effective way to keep people engaged. Now, your imaginary friend is not doing that because literally it's in your imagination. And I appreciate the analogy. And there is this, there's a researcher named Sonia Dittwari. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Or Tiwari, who's doing a lot of work at what's the difference between companions and characters. This idea that characters and imaginary friends, like there's a fantastical side of this that's part of creativity and imagination. And then there's companionship, which is I'm pulled towards you and I am gradually bonding more and more with you and becoming reliant on you. And I think that's the more sinister side, that if you're running a business that's engagement at all costs business model, that's where you're going to see the market move.
It almost mirrors what the social media companies have been doing for the last decade and a half of investing billions of pounds in the top psychologists and researchers to your attention on that app with the endless scroll, the intermittent reward.
Yeah.
I am seeing the parallels in AI from what you're saying. And in the sense that social media decreases our attention span, do you think AI could be decreasing, obviously, from what you're saying, our connection with others, but also maybe our knowledge because we're outsourcing our brain power to the ChatGPTs and stuff? What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
So first off, just on the comparison to social media, absolutely. And social media is now using these companion bots, right? So it's like, it's the new playbook inside of Meta and anyways, other tools like Instagram and Meta now have these non-person character bots. Anyways, I could just like rant about that, but I'm trying to pull back from that and answer your question, which is around offloading, right? Cognitive offloading is a big concern. Obviously, in the education space where I spend a lot of time, that's the big, is every use of AI cheating? If a student is using AI, at what point are they just not learning? And I think honestly, the research on this is mixed. There's some very alarming research out of MIT suggesting that is happening at high rates. There's other research suggesting that it actually builds human capacity to see how an AI tool answers a question, and then you're learning by virtue of seeing its answer. I'm really worried about emotional offloading, meaning if I'm just interacting with a bot all the time that is, again, trained to be sycophantic, I'm atrophying my muscle to be in the natural friction of a human relationship. Again, research is still really thin on this. Like, it makes sense as a hypothesis, but I want to be a responsible researcher and say there's mixed findings on whether that muscle is indeed atrophying on the basis of interacting with companion apps. But that's my real fear, right? Especially for young people who have not built that muscle in the real world, just by virtue of their age and experience, to grow up surrounded by an AI tutor, an AI mentor, an AI coach, an AI lover, an AI best friend. Where do you find like the reps to actually be capable of human relationships and all of the complexity those bring?
Yeah. What are the long-term implications potentially of this new wave of AI companions? You just mentioned AI lovers. Does that mean fertility rate and birth rate is going to drop down even more in Western countries than it already is? What are the implications of this?
Yeah, I think that's a good possibility. A survey from the Institute for Family Studies here in the US found that 1 in 4 young people believe that an AI relationship could replace a real romantic one. So not insignificant numbers of folks. Heavy porn users are much more likely to say that. Again, there's these gateway drugs of social media or porn or other like digital engagement stuff that I think has made some of these forms of intimacy and connection much more palatable and socially acceptable. So yes, I think birth rates, I think social cohesion, I think resilience in the face of natural disasters. Social capital is a huge predictor of how quickly communities recuperate from natural disasters, basically people helping people. Access to opportunities, an estimated half of jobs and internships come through social connection. So if you're not, again, if you're like, my AI system is much better to talk to than my colleagues, you're not actually investing in your sort of future labor market optionality at the rate you might want to, especially in a turbulent labor market. And then I think I am not religious. I'm a fallen Catholic, but at some spiritual level, a reckoning with what it means to be human if we are getting all forms of social support through non-social actors begs really big questions about the soul level of all this.
Yeah. Scary. And do you think AI companions will be or already are as addictive and disruptive as social media was? Obviously, combining the double-edged sword of AI companions and social media, that's crazy. But as AI companions solely, do you think they're as addictive, if not more?
Yeah, I'm concerned that they are. And again, I think they are. Social media is a complex story. It's not one-sided. It's not that it was all bad. I think half of Gen Z says they wish TikTok was never invented, according to Horace Hare's poll. So there are hindsight is 2020 with some of this stuff. And the marvelous fact that we can connect at the press of a button, that we can stay connected to people we went to elementary school with, right? All of these ways in which social media has actually allowed us to hold much bigger networks than our brains could handle in the analog world. That's a huge social upside. And I think the question to ask about AI companions is similar. Do these become tools for becoming more pro-social, building our muscle to engage in high conflict situations or engage across lines of difference? Do they become sources of social and mental support so that we're healthier when we go offline back into our communities? Now, again, I think that's a rosy story. Techno-optimists will be like, yes, that's exactly what happens, right? And yet we know that's one side of the story. But I do think this gets back to my business model question. If you're building a business model premised on engagement or re-engagement, that's where we have to really worry that the incentives are fully stacked in this direction of addiction and unhealthy attached to a technology, or in this case, a technology that seems like a person.
Yeah. And will AI companions, do you think, eventually become better than a real human connection? And specifically, what are the consequences of that, if that happens on our mental health? Do you think it's a positive or a negative?
Yeah. Again, how we define better than is like a very complex, it's like a philosophical question. It's a market question. That Andreessen Horowitz memo I mentioned, it's not a companion, it's a computer. They start off, it's like a college essay where you start off with a quote. And the quote they chose was from a Karen AI user. Karen AI is one of these like AI girlfriends. And it's a user saying, eventually, this version will be better than the real thing. Textbook disruptive innovation. And I think if the real thing is defined by fulfilling my emotional needs, as we get into sort of the robotics world, potentially fulfilling my carnal and sexual needs, like, yes, it could get better than. And I think that you've already mentioned, I think I just gave the litany of reasons why that has huge risks to sort of social fabric and well-being. What I do think is that if you look at the way the human connection works and the way this market works, is face-to-face connection is still the sort of high end of the market here, right? It's the thing that is not as susceptible to getting disrupted because of all the new unique things that happen when you are face-to-face with a person, not just like logistically, but chemically, right? You actually have much higher levels of empathy when you're in person than even on a Zoom call. This is higher levels of empathy than if we were texting, but still. And so I am pretty confident that AI will not disrupt face-to-face connection. I am less confident that our policies and our culture are prioritizing face-to-face connection enough. Mm-hmm. Meaning if we don't double down on it and we keep moving our social circles online, we are then much more susceptible to those social circles getting displaced by bots. And that comes sort of like the bigger call to action here in the US. There's a ton, I know it's happening in Europe as well, but there's a ton of legislation trying to tamp down on particularly AI companions because of this, their highly disruptive potential. And a lot of policymakers are gaining political capital, yelling about how evil Silicon Valley is right now. Those same policymakers are not gaining political capital by saying we need to invest more in human connection, which is actually the way to inoculate us against a lot of these threats. But it's not sexy. It's not cool. It's way more complicated than just saying, let's shut down and regulate the tech. And so that's where I actually feel a lot of hope and optimism, and also the need for more advocacy, is that we can still safeguard human connection if we double down on face-to-face.
Yeah.
Because your AI has a way lesser competitive advantage.
But do you think because it's such a disruptive technology and Silicon Valley putting so much research and money into it, do you think there will be a time when people have more AI friends than human friends? And do you think it's inevitable that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, there was a quote from Mark Zuckerberg this summer basically outlining that dystopian future, being like he was noting there's something, again, here in the US that Daniel Cox, a researcher at AEI, has called a friendship recession. We have fewer and fewer friends, but that's not aligned to how many friends we want. So Zuckerberg said on some podcast, I think the average American wants 15 friends and only has 3 or something. And so he's doing the math there of, okay, the ratio is going to bend towards AI companions filling that gap. This is a place where I don't quite know what to predict. I think there's like a culture shift that is harder to predict than the market shifts. If the market does what the market wants to do, yes, is the answer to your question. But I think there's enough headwinds right now in the culture around distrust in these companies, and particularly when it comes to young people wanting to protect childhood, that we may have a shot. I'm actually quite worried about like 18 to 30 year olds who are the COVID generation, who are hitting the job market when entry-level work is getting disrupted in unprecedented ways by AI, who have, you know, the gateway drug of social media and are already using their phones. Like that generation I'm in some ways more worried about than our youngest, who I think are going to benefit from some of this like pendulum swinging back in favor of real life interaction, tamping down on phone addiction, and regulating some of these tools.
Mm. And how can we actually invest more into pro-social and in-person relationships then? What's the solution to that too?
Yeah, totally. So I think there's a lot of policies around green spaces, amenities, like not having pay-to-play sports, but having widely available sports for young people. I think a lot at the sort of civic infrastructure level, at the level of a town or a city or a region, is critical, right? It's not, you can't just have a national agenda on this. It's actually quite local. And there's a researcher named Sam Pressler who put out this amazing framework called the Connective Tissue Policy Framework that outlines a lot of those opportunities. I also think I actually have some optimism that we can use AI to support this, right? So AI could be a pro-social tool. The market just doesn't really bend in that direction necessarily. It bends towards productivity and this replacement issue. But if you look at Boardy, which is a tool for entrepreneurs to find talent, Boardy is essentially an AI tool that you like call up, you share a bunch about yourself, and then the bot goes and finds people in a network that would be productive connections and is a matchmaker. Similarly, Siri, a startup out of Yale College, is a new social network with AI playing this kind of back-end connector role. And that is a really exciting function that, frankly, like we've underinvested in that brokering function. We leave it to heroic individuals or whatever Malcolm Gladwell calls like super connectors who like do that, but it's not widely accessible all the time for you to find people who would help you make progress in your life or help you have networks aligned to your interests and passions. And so I think there's a huge AI infrastructure play here if we can get enough patient capital supporting entrepreneurs with that vision of the world, as opposed to the vision of like, you're just you and your bots in a dark.
Yeah, yeah. But something I noticed was, I remember my dad always talking about going to the youth club, and I didn't have that near me. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of non-AI traditional things. And also, I guess,
physical infrastructure kind
of. Yeah, and also, I guess, church as well. As like, even if, whatever you think about religion, it did have that community.
Absolutely.
Aspect to it, even if it was a bit dogmatic, but that would have made you become friends with the people three blocks away or three roads away.
Absolutely.
Which isn't really the case anymore. And then also, yeah, after COVID as well, a lot of stuff became remote and people became more introverted
or digitally engaged. Yeah. Analog engaged. Yeah, it's interesting. So when I first started at the Christensen Institute, Clay Christensen passed away in 2020, but I had the chance to be mentored by him. And I went to him with the social capital research idea. And Clay, for those who don't know, was a very devout Mormon. And so he looked at me a little sideways when I was talking about the need for innovations around social capital, because if you're in a sort of religious machine, a lot of this is taken care of. Yet we know that religious affiliation is on the decline. And yeah, so I'd argue we need these secular solutions alongside religion. We need the youth clubs. We need to reinvigorate here in America, the YMCA, these other institutions that are third places where people can go. And there's certainly, I would say there's a lot of energy around that in a sort of social entrepreneur way. I don't think we've unlocked the kind of public money that is really necessary to make that widely accessible, sustainable, and actually relational, as opposed to a place that maybe you can go, but is there enough care and thought put into making sure that it's a safe social space and that people are coming back to it and there's a sense of belonging that then generates sort of a really viable alternative to online life?
But the thing is with online life and social media, it's a blessing and a curse in the sense that, yeah, you can really hone in on your interests and find creators who think like you and act like you, or you want or want to be like or talk
admire,
like you're,
yeah,
interested in, like podcasts that I listen to are really specific, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's a blessing. But then the curse of that is when you're in person and if you have a really niche interest, I don't know, ceramic pottery. That's not that niche, but I can't think of anything else.
What is a niche?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're a 40-year-old woman, it's not that niche. But
but if you're young, it can, yeah, be. Whatever the niche interest is, right? If you combine a niche interest that you found on the internet with your lack of sociability because you're on the internet too much and you probably have a bit of social anxiety like I used to have,
yeah,
it makes it really hard to relate to people and find people in person. So you don't go out and do it, or when you don't relate to the people, even if you went to the social club, therefore it's not rewarding that, and yes, it's more rewarding to just go online. So how do we fix that? Because the cards are stacked against the incentive of going out in person if you're the person I'm just describing, which is a lot of people my age and younger.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people need social skills, but they also need practice. That's how you build confidence that then translates into being able to engage in those spaces in a way that feels embodied and rewarding. And so I hesitate to be like school is the answer, because school can for many people be where dreams go to die, and it's not, yeah, really premised on this sort of social value add. But I do think it's a place where, when done well, young people are getting those reps to build the confidence to be in relationship. And again, this is where I'm very wary of the story being written by AI evangelists that like bots are going to be the way we build that muscle. I think that's a little bit nutty, but I'm a little bit wait and see if there's a possibility. Great. So I think the idea of places to practice, low stakes places to practice, I think there's a parenting layer to this that's really hard to talk about. I have 3 and 5 year old daughters, so I'm not quite here yet. And I'm like really banking on the next 3 years that we as a society figure this out. But I think parents have become more insular. And the idea of just low stakes play earlier in childhood, where you normalize those behaviors, I think that needs to be carved out more. That needs to be potentially subsidized so that all families have access to it. But it also just needs to be prioritized more in the kind of modern parenting paradigm that is a little more managerial and a little more about like the insular family unit. But I might put it back to you because I do think back to my concern about 18 to 30 year olds right now. You're 19. How old are you again?
21.
21, sorry. So in this demo that I think you're right, that there's a lot of headwinds when it comes to wanting to form offline community. Like, where do you see the greatest opportunities or sort of innovation spaces?
I don't know, in terms of like spaces, I think youth club would be pretty cool. The closest thing we had to that was Scouts. I always remember wishing that there was a youth club. And then most of the friendships I had when I was younger was football. That was because my dad encouraged me to go to that and my parents encouraged me to go to that. So I don't know what it'd be like for people that don't have that. But in terms of recently, and maybe in the last year or two, I've got more into self-improvement and the gym and signing up to a health club, which has a sauna and a steam room. This entire summer, I've made so many friends through that way. But then again, that's not very cheap.
The pay-to-play layer of that is like a little worrisome, but it's an example of finding opportunities that align to your goals and other people's. And I think that's also where there's a whole layer. And the other thing I'm watching, which we don't have to go off on this huge tangent, but AI is a giant self-help machine. And that is great. And it also reinforces rugged individualism and aloneness, right? And so it's like you're doing a version of self-help in the analog world when you're going and sitting in the sauna. And it happens to be a thing that other people are trying to help themselves do. And therefore you're forming community. And I think that's where, again, like, that, because this is going to sound totally nuts, but like going to that sauna becomes an act of resistance against this like other alternative to self-help, which is just like you have an AI personal trainer, it's in your earbuds and you're not talking to anyone, right?
Yeah.
And so I just think building an awareness and being able to feel the contrast of those two experiences is really powerful. But I think we're in a moment where we have to like double, triple, quadruple down on those in real life spaces, make it not just the will of the individual or their pocket, like we have to have system level solutions to this. Otherwise, things are moving the wrong direction.
Yeah, and there's this thing in like self-improvement called the lonely chapter. And it's quite dangerous because if you just want to lock in, go to the gym and maybe study and improve yourself, improve your diet, et cetera, you often feel like you have to step away from people around you that aren't doing that, which is okay. Mm-hmm. And I think is necessary a lot of the time. It's something I've done. But if you're the type of personality who's quite obsessive and driven and introverted, you don't go out of the lonely chapter. But the whole point of the lonely chapter was to improve yourself so then you come back into society, reintegrate. Beautiful. But most people aren't doing that in my generation, especially because of the stuff we're talking about and the prevalence of social media and a lot of social media content that's perfectly attuned to our interests. And I could only see AI companions that are perfectly attuned to our desires and our problems through algorithms and what we search up on the internet. That's going to be dangerous because people are just going to get reinforced and rewarded for interacting with those instead of going out into the real world and going to the sauna and talking to people at the gym. And I feel so much better when I'm more extroverted and meeting new people, even if I am a little bit of an introvert.
You're getting a serotonin hit.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a fundamental part of human nature, isn't it? But I can't imagine how potentially dangerous it could be when these AI companions are on everything and they're completely personalized to us as an individual.
Yeah. Yeah. It's highly disruptive to a fundamental layer of the social fabric that I think for a really long time we've taken for granted. The loneliness epidemic is a lagging indicator of the fact that we treat loneliness as an individual problem, which is an oxymoron. So anyways, I'm hopeful that pro-social policies and that some of the civic renewal work around entrepreneurs that are trying to create more of these spaces and make them widely accessible, I think there's hope in both of those, but I think we have to be aware that's part of the playbook alongside regulating the tech if we want to live into a future where we get the best of AI, but we still have flourishing social real life relationships.
And you were saying that it could potentially become as good as a human interaction, but like you were saying, there's less empathy and there's less chemical release potentially when it's online and virtual. What do you think? Do you think it will ever become the case where there's going to be like robots in person that's exactly like humans and it will give you the exact same chemical and nervous system positive response as socializing with a real person?
Yeah. So I don't know the neuroscience of that, but I do know that like we already live in a world where those robots exist, right? They're just not mainstream. And like just to take it back a level to the digital space, like an AI companion can alleviate loneliness on par with a fellow human. Wow. There's research showing that. So that's a short-term sensation of loneliness. Now, again, maybe curing loneliness and scaling isolation. So there's this long-term cost that we're bad at accounting for as individuals and that the market doesn't pay any attention to. So yes, it's already here. And again, it has to do with, I think we need the research to understand what's different and what's the threshold at which AI starts to cross over into being as good as human. But I think it's just as important to have the cultural conversation to norm around why do we need each other? Why do we care about each other? Why is underinvesting now in human connection actually cost me later when unpredicted things in the future unfold, right? When the labor market changes, when there's a natural disaster, when I have an emergency and I need someone, or when I want to live a more fulfilling life, which warm relationships are literally the leading predictor of happiness in old age. And again, AI optimists would say, great, we can scale warm relationships with AI companions. To your question, I like the fact that research focuses on warm relationships, AKA stronger ones. I suspect that there's a layer of that has to do with face-to-face, in-person, and some of that like chemical layer. But I am not even claiming to play a neuroscientist on TV here.
Yeah. But is the AI companions therefore a short-term gain for a potentially long-term pain or long-term problem? It doesn't fix the long-term solution. If you were depressed or suffering with anxiety and you just try to fix it, or the doctor just gave you SSRIs or medication, but then once you're off that, surely you're going to still have the long-term problem. It's not a permanent fix. Is that the same with similar to AI companions?
Yeah, I hesitate to say that. I'm a child of a psychiatrist, so I actually think medication can be really powerful in an enduring way in that case. But I do think it's saying if you don't actually address the root causes and think about the lifestyle shifts, not just the point solutions that you need in your life, then there are going to be these long-term costs. I also want to clarify, just for any listeners who are hearing this who are using AI companions, it can feel like a lot of what I'm talking about is shaming that. And it's in fact the opposite. What I want to shame is the fact that society has disregarded human connection so much that these companions are incredibly alluring.
Yeah.
Like that it's a collective action problem, not that it's shameful as an individual to turn to these tools. It's actually highly rational. Just want to offer that caveat because I think it's a lot of what Silicon Valley is exploiting right now is a failure of imagination and investment in human connection. On all of us.
Yeah. But is that rational on their behalf, do you think? Do you think it's because they're trying to just be as effective and efficient and I guess as cost effective as possible? And
Silicon Valley or individual?
Yeah, Silicon Valley. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's such an interesting time to be researching disruptive innovation because the theory of disruptive innovation is descriptive, not normative, meaning it's just describing how markets work over time. It's not saying that's good or bad. There were certainly casualties when RCA got disrupted by Sony, but on net consumers won because we got more affordable, high quality products over time. But I think right now it's really hard to talk about disruption without considering the normative sort of values of what is gained versus what is lost. And Clay Christensen lived into that space. Like one of his most successful books was called How Will You Measure Your Life, which took all of these theories that he developed in the academy looking at businesses and firms and applied it to the level of the individual. And it was interesting because it was like, how you measure your life is based on this axiom of what gets measured gets done in an organization. And what I've come to see in my work around relationships is it's not just what gets measured gets done, it's what gets valued gets measured gets done. And we're at a moment right now where we are seeing, we have seen it all along with social media, but we are now seeing in like bold size 72 font, like what the values or lack thereof of these firms are. And I think that, yes, their values are profit and productivity. And I think we have to reckon as consumers and citizens of, okay, what are our values beyond? And that's not a new point to make, but it feels really acutely important right now, given the speed and scale of these tools and given the capabilities that they have to encroach on things that we hold as deeply human, like our relationships.
Yeah. And from psychology, like journals and papers that I've skimmed over and got AI to summarize for me. They've said stuff about how increased social media use is linked to increased anxiety
and depression.
So surely, potentially, AI companions may have that similar effect where, again, it's the short-term dopamine and you think it's helping you and connecting you with your friends. But once you get hijacked and you have the For You page and the feeds and the addictiveness, surely that might be a similar or parallel to AI companions. Do you think that could happen as well?
I think it could happen. I think again, like I said earlier, I think the business model is bent towards that.
Yeah.
There's some research. A researcher at Princeton named Rose Gingrich has recently come out with a couple of papers showing that people using AI companions did not see, in a self-reported sense, did not see their social health go down. Now, interestingly, in one of those studies, the comparison group was folks spending 10 minutes on like a word game app versus 10 minutes on a companion app. So one of the things I'm looking for more research on is, are we so awash in digital media that like this is, people are taking their addiction to one type of technology and then pivoting and talking to companions. And so we're not going to see that cost show up immediately because there's already a lot of unhealthy behavior in our baseline. But I just want to caveat, like, there's a lot we don't know. We know more about usage than we do about impact.
Yeah.
And usage is growing. Yeah. Like, Character AI was one of the fastest scaling AI tools. And if you look at, again, Andreessen Horowitz has run some of these numbers, engagement with AI companion apps is like 20x engagement with other types of AI tools, right? Mm-hmm. So we know there's a stickiness factor. Again, do we call that addiction? That feels like a little bit of a leap, but a hypothesis that I could get behind.
It's probably going to be one of those where we're only going to see the impacts in a decade or two, like with social media, like with, I guess,
right,
as well.
Like we choose, right, maybe that, or maybe we use history as a guide and say, let's actually not wait a whole decade. Let's come up with ways to understand what's happening more in real time, right? So let's do more active research on the front end. And let's also draw some lines around where we actually just think we don't want to take the risk, which again, this is like I'm going through a funny identity crisis in my career because I have spent years celebrating the potential of disruptive innovation. And now I'm using it to say, no, wait a second. There's actually a disruption that we should be slowing down, if not halting. Yeah, it's a wild time to be studying this stuff, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think history shows that not everyone's good at learning from history. History doesn't repeat itself.
Right.
Human nature does.
That's very well said. Yeah.
Yeah, but why do you think there's ever been another disruptive innovation that's, in your opinion, had this much potential negative impact that people have said, okay, no, let's not try and do this or not? Doesn't nuclear bomb count as one?
Yeah, I'm trying to I did go to like weapons and stuff like that, right? Drones are highly disruptive in terms of traditional warfare. And we could not my area of expertise, but we could have a debate around how that has impacted a whole slew of shadow foreign policy structures. I'll leave it at that. My husband works in national security, so I'm like, am I even using the right nouns and verbs when I say that? Probably. But yeah, I don't have a great analogy, but thanks for pushing me because I think it would be helpful. I don't have a great analogy. I think what feels unique about this is not the fact that it's like a highly disruptive technology. It's the nature of the technology having these anthropomorphic qualities. And people would say like the printing press could produce words the way that like oral storytellers did before. So there have been analogous things, but this is eerily close to who we are. To me, it feels different, but I may go back on that. I want to be like, don't quote me on that, but we're on a podcast, so I guess I'm being quoted on.
Yeah, no, we can't predict the future.
Yeah.
Just estimate and have our best guess. But what about virtual reality and the metaverse and stuff like that? Combining that with AI companions is surely going to be very disruptive.
Yeah, again, that sort of, as you think about disruptive innovations move up market. So we go from like the Sony Walkman to the like much higher quality boombox, which doesn't mean anything to you because you're young, but that was like the kind of, like exciting new equivalent to a tabletop radio back in the 80s. And so gradually you serve more and more demanding customers with better features, better functionalities, higher price. If you think about immersive experiences that VR can lend on top of this social layer that like makes it a less individual experience, I think that's just a sustaining innovation where people are getting more out of the interaction because it's contextualized. And there's a ton of, I would argue, really exciting, but like I'm slightly wary of innovation happening in the education space around this, right? Where you're able to do much more rich simulated learning and you can be with other students in the VR space learning and interacting with these AI companions. So it's not definitionally going to be like a lone pursuit situation. If you look at, obviously, like video games are like highly social right now. I think the question I keep coming back to is fine, and why not in the real world? What? Okay, it's going to be more affordable and more scalable, maybe, or is that just that we've taken on a weird scarcity mindset about real world learning or real world experience that's a little bit of a false binary? Yeah, I actually see a lot of potential there on the learning front, and I have a lot of questions on the what are we betting on?
Yeah. And what's one action or insight you think the audience should take after listening to this conversation?
Spend time face-to-face with humans in your life. And that is, if you have any wariness about how big tech is acting upon you, not of your own volition, that is the way to play offense. That is what inoculates you against some of these harms. And that doesn't mean you can't use AI. It doesn't mean that this isn't a marvelous tool, but it means that we're not handing over something so precious as our human connections to these tools that were designed to disrupt.
Yeah, and it just makes sure, like you said earlier, the society cohesion, because we're not in our echo chambers, we're exploring the world, meeting new people, listening to different opinions, which is very important to avoid conflict.
In this political moment, it feels unbelievably important.
Yeah, and if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
Oh, it's actually really consistent with this of just keep meeting people and don't be so neurotic and socially anxious. And I can't even blame Facebook or Instagram for that. I was just a little bit of that by nature. But I think sometimes in my education work, I talk a lot about the importance of building a network. And I like hate that word, especially as an introvert. Like networking is such a vile pursuit. But I actually now break it down to the level of conversation, like just have conversations with people, not just bots. Have as many conversations as you can that will like either by design or default expand your sense of future possible selves. And that is really, if you are using AI, think about how to calibrate, okay, how many conversations am I having with ChatGPT and how many conversations am I having with people I don't know well or people I've never met? Because that's another way to bet on your future self.
And how can people have deeper conversations with the new people they're meeting?
The science on this says that like vulnerability is the like linchpin of a lot of that. If you've read Brené's Brown stuff, where if you can't be vulnerable, you don't actually get to know people as well. And I'm not trying to go all the way in the direction of like trauma bonding, but not trying to appear to have it all together is, I think, actually ironically a way to build a better network. So that's probably number one. And then I think there's a phenomenon in sociology called homophily, which is birds of a feather flock together. Similarity breeds trust.
Yeah.
And it's actually what Adam Grant has talked about, is that it's uncommon commonalities that have the greatest stickiness. And that requires like sharing stuff about yourself to even find uncommon commonalities. There's no way, it's not just like your race or gender or religion. It's actually these much more subtle attributes of your personality, your passions, your interests, your lived experience that are going to open up those moments of potential connection with someone else who's lived those things or cares about those things. And so you have to open up to get to that juicy place of trust. So yeah, that's another. Yeah,
that's really good advice. And it's something I've noticed since doing this podcast, is every time I've opened up or asked vulnerable questions, or even just mentioned one little thing about myself in, like you said, a non kind of braggy way, in a vulnerable way, it's always made the conversation so much better. And I guess it is that human urge for reciprocity as well. If you're vulnerable, they're going to be more likely to reciprocate.
Yeah, whether it's fair or not, I like implicitly trust you more now that I know you're a fellow introvert, right? Like, it's like, yeah, he's in it for the right reason. He's not out here just trying to meet people.
Yeah. 100%.
But yeah, it is that sort of like sharing of yourself and like understanding that people are many dimensions behind whatever their profile looks like.
And yeah, I agree with the networking thing as well. It just sounds very like transactional and just fake and surface level. Like when I think of networking, I don't think like sitting down and having a deep conversation.
Real conversation. Yeah.
It's just, oh, you can help me with this. Oh, I can help you with that. Done. Forget about you. See you later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't test well in message testing. So yes, that is like connection is the word and has, I think, better connotations for obvious reasons. But again, drill down to that level of conversation, I think feels both more manageable and potentially more enriching.
Exactly. Exactly. Very good advice. That's where we'll leave it. Julia Freeland Fisher, ladies and gentlemen, Julia, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate this. And yeah, no, it's going to change. A lot's changing. The AI companionship is something I wasn't even aware of until I studied your work. But I, like you said, with disruptive innovations, it's probably just going to flood everything exponentially very soon. So it's something that's super important and people really need to be aware of. Where can people go if they want to find your work and check out more of your stuff?
Yeah, totally. I have a Substack called Connection Error, where I think out loud about what's happening in this space. I try and post a lot about the new research coming out and just like what's happening in the market, what's happening in policy. And I'm also on LinkedIn.
Awesome. I'll leave the links to that in the show notes below. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jacob. It was such a pleasure.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show, but you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.